Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is your host, Alan Lee, and welcome to episode 34 of The Vampire Squid. I just got back from playing soccer in my new soccer league, so I am quite exhausted, but wanted to get this episode out for you guys because it's a very interesting one. Today's episode is going to be on investing in an alternative investment structure, which is royalties. And these include royalties from songwriters, from the artists themselves. I had never known that you could actually invest into royalties, but we brought on the CFO of Royalty Exchange, which is the platform for investing into these royalties, onto the show so that he could share what this new investment structure is all about, how his company makes money, what are some of the most popular royalties that have been exchanged, which interestingly enough has included the theme song for Dora the Explorer. So this episode is pretty jam-packed, and Jeff starts talking about Royalty Exchange specifically around 10 minutes in, but he shares a lot of his background from working with James Altucher to starting a health and wellness startup, and how that culminated into his role as CFO at Royalty Exchange. So I hope you guys enjoy, and without further ado, please welcome Jeff. Jeff Schneider, and he is the CFO of Royalty Exchange. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on to the show.
I appreciate you having us, Alan. Thank you very much.
Of course. Would you mind giving a quick background on yourself so that our listeners know who they're listening to?
Yeah, certainly. So I grew up in the Midwest and did a traditional kind of path. I actually, after graduating from school, went into the corporate world for a few years. I did mostly my background was in finance. So I did some auditing and I was a controller at General Electric for a few years. And at a certain stage, I realized I had to just step down and try my own path. And since then, it's been about 7 or 8 years and had several entrepreneurial ventures since then.
That's great. And you went to Purdue for undergrad and grad, is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it's Purdue has a very unique program that as I was going through the kind of the recruiting process and all the scoping out, they have a program where you can actually slash a year off of your undergrad and squeeze all of your undergrad into 3 years. And then do a full 2-year MBA. And since I knew finance was the path I wanted to head down, I figured why waste some extra time? So I didn't really make it. Actually, this is probably the first time I'm making it publicly available. But I didn't really make that known to anybody that was what I was hoping to do because they only accept 4 or 5 people into that program. But I just positioned myself in the first 3 years. It's pretty simple. You just have to be very engaged and you have to have good grades, and you go through an interview process, and I was accepted into that program where you get your MBA for the kind of fourth year and fifth year.
So you went directly from undergrad into the MBA?
That's correct, yep.
Did you find that, some of your maybe counterparts, having had worked in the industry or had done a little bit of work for 2 or 4 years, what was the dynamic like?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say the two major factors, first, I think it's always good to play up a level and, surrounding yourself with people who had a lot more experience than me, certainly was intimidating kind of that first year of MBA, realizing that the average person had 7 years of work experience. But, I'm a competitive person by nature. So I knew if I worked as hard and I could hang with them. And so I was just making sure I was quiet and listening and proved my value in kind of teams and meetings. And over time, you can establish yourself as that. So I think playing up a level is always good. The interesting part of it was actually trying to get a job out of an MBA. So although I felt I could hang with my peers in class, when you go and start interviewing, for regular corporate jobs, the comparison they have with you having little experience was definitely an interesting dynamic. I did lots of interviews, and as I was wrapping up my MBA, and I had 3 or 4 internships. So I had some experience, but when I look back on it now, after about 7 or 8 interviews, I didn't get any job offers. I changed the answer to like a single question, and suddenly I had 4 job offers in the next like few weeks. And it was a pretty interesting path.
You didn't change your birthday, was it?
No, I didn't change my birthday. I had to do that at some of my jobs actually, but not while I was interviewing.
What was the thing that you changed that resulted in you getting those 4 job offers?
I think, obviously it's always easy to look back, but a lot of the interviewers would ask, you know, hey, they were very direct and they'd say, you know, we're interviewing people who have a lot more experience than you. Why do you think you can compete with them basically? Or why should we hire you over them? And my response before that was all the, I'll work hard and I'm going to do it. But I just changed the answer as I was realizing it wasn't working. And I changed the answer to simply, I've proven that I can compete with them and be better than them for the last 2 years, and there's no reason that that's not going to continue. And suddenly I had lots of job offers.
I like that. So what was your first job after your MBA?
It was a medical device company up in Minnesota called Boswell. It was originally Guidant, and then it was acquired by Boston Scientific.
Got it. And what was your role there?
It was basically an internal consulting and auditing group. So we basically would go from different divisions or different sales organizations within the company and make sure that best practices were getting around, making sure that company policies were in place. And really, it was an internal consulting gig.
Gotcha. And I'm looking, briefly at your background. You worked with James Altucher too. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was just last year. And so we basically, he had always, you're familiar with his podcast?
He's one of the people that inspired me to start a podcast, actually. Yeah, I've listened to his podcast. I read a lot of his answers on Quora. He's definitely one of the most interesting people that I've encountered on the web.
Yeah, and that was my same impression. So for all the same reasons, when the opportunity came to work with James, I jumped at that. And basically, you're familiar then with his kind of free podcast and his free newsletter.
Yep.
So what we wanted to do is build product around him. So we built a few products around him, beginning of last year, I guess it was.
Yeah. So, and for my listeners that might not know James, some of his stories were, you know, he would make millions in his 20s, but then he would go broke. He started a hedge fund and then he was a coder. He started a job and quit within a month. This guy has the most extravagant background that I've ever read. But, what was he like in person?
Oh, I mean, he's the exact same, really. I mean, he's a great person. You know, he's got a very soft heart. You know, he's a great listener. But you know, all of the same things you've read, you know, he's very transparent in those items, and he can relate with anybody because of his stories and the way he tells them.
That's great. And you know, before we jump into Royalty Exchange, I want to touch on one more thing, which is the Early Rise that you did. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Early Rise is was another online publication and business around healthy, wealthy, and wise is, you know, Benjamin Franklin's old quote. It had been around since 2001, and I got involved in it in 2011. And we, you know, the focus there is just helping people live better, more intentional lives. And it's a very interesting topic. It focuses on anything from wealth creation, which, you know, I've had a lot of interest in since I was really young, to personal productivity. So making sure that, you know, you're getting the most out of your day and you're the most productive in your day. And I would say you probably with the full-time day job that you have and being able to fit some of these other things into it, I'm sure you're very familiar with trying to squeeze everything in.
Yeah, I think we could all, you know, do a little bit better on the productivity. My I need to delete some of my social media apps on the phone, though.
That's actually one rule I have. I don't have any social media on my phone.
You don't use any?
I'm sure I have a Facebook account, but I don't let anything go to my phone.
I think that has to be one of my first steps towards better productivity, because, I mean, with the Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat, I think that might take up, you know, a significant percentage of my daytime.
Yeah. So the other one that I would say, it's probably hard for a lot of people to take social media off of their phone, but one thing that I've definitely done recently is actually just kept my phone on silent most of the time.
I actually do that myself.
Yeah. Unless I'm expecting a call or something like that, just leave it on silent and you will not be distracted by it. You can't let yourself.
That's interesting. So, you know, just looking back, you did this health and wellness at Early Rise. You worked with James Altucher. You know, you worked at the medical device company. How did that, you know, culminate into the CFO role that you currently have at Realty Exchange?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I've always been in interested in finance, and I've taken some time off as I, you know, my corporate roles were in finance. And then as I went down the more entrepreneurial path, there were just a lot of different skills I needed to learn. Everything from managing, marketing, you know, some of the technical side of things, mm-hmm. all of those things kind of build and stack upon each other. And when Royalty Exchange, you know, the opportunity came about, it was, you know, what I viewed as something from personally interesting, but also from a marketplace and a niche. It's very unique in what its services are, and it's a great timing for the music business. So I viewed this as something where it all comes together. It complements kind of my finance background, but also from a market. You know, I think this is a great place and opportunity within the market to be able to provide something that adds a lot of value to both sides of the marketplace.
And could you give maybe, a background on what Realty Exchange does, so our listeners can become familiar? Because, you know, you can read the website, but I think coming from you, everyone will have a much better idea.
Sure. So Royalty Exchange is basically, it's an alternative asset marketplace where individuals can buy and sell royalty income streams. And so investors are interested in royalties right now because yields are low across the entire world. So if a lot of your audience is in the finance, that's nothing new to them. And royalties is basically, it's cash flow income. And it's a great opportunity for these investors to find yield that doesn't exist anywhere else. And then right now we're focused in the music business. And so the value that we create for the musicians and artists is that they have a need for funding in their careers. And what we allow them to do is leverage their back catalog, you know, music that they've already created that is already generating royalties, and they can leverage that to basically they sell those off to get income for their future projects.
So does the artist already have to be generating royalties to use a service, or could they be a new artist and come in and say, hey, I need some money up front because I don't have enough marketing, I can't go to the shows I want, and then my future royalties, you can get a percentage?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are definitely differentiated from a crowdfunding type model. So the model where you're a brand new artist and, you know, you're kind of just starting to get traction, that is most likely built for a crowdfunding type marketplace. So those exist, Indiegogo and some of these others. What we focus on, individuals and musicians who have a catalog that are already existing and generating cash flow.
Interesting. So these seem like a pretty safe asset then, if they're already generating these royalties.
Yeah. I mean, so safe is a relative term, right? So these things are generating cash. So what you know is that you have a history and it's really hard to predict the future. And so the more consistent they are, the more value that an investor will see in it. But certainly there are assets that have more volatility than others. And so it's the same from an investor's perspective. What we do is make all of the information available for investors to basically make their own judgment call on what the valuation may be.
Would you mind walking us through about, you know, how someone would potentially diligence an artist? So say that, you know, I wanted to invest in an artist on Royalty Exchange. You know, what are some of the diligence items that I'd look at before I invest in X artist?
Sure. I think there's qualitative and quantitative items there, right? So it's not necessarily about an individual artist, because we do have a lot of songwriters or publishers who actually service a lot more than a single artist. And so it's more about a catalog, you know, a combined catalog than any one particular artist. And, you know, through the quantitative measures are really looking at the historical performance. And so what we do is we make an entire database. Usually we ask for 3 years worth of data so that an investor can go back and see which songs pay out, how much per quarter, the change in the flow, what are the sources? Does it come from digital, you know, Spotify use, or does it come from other things? So we make all of that available to the investor. That's the quantitative measure. And through that, you know, they can make judgments on where it may go into the future.
Wait, sorry. So just to be clear, so I'm not investing in any certain artist's royalties. I'm investing in a pool of artist royalties. Is that how it works?
No, not a pool. Sorry about that. It's not a pool. It's basically supporting one individual from the artist community, you know, which not every artist it writes all of their own songs. You know, if you look at country, for example, Kenny Chesney only writes a small fraction of his songs. There are actually songwriters who are writing for him full time. And they're actually writing not only the lyrics, but they're kind of creating the first generation of the music and the sound.
Okay.
And a lot of what we service are some of these people who are behind the scenes and not only the mainstream artists.
So my dollar goes to help support the ghostwriters. Is that accurate?
They're not ghostwriters. They're all named and it's all public. If you go buy a Kenny Chesney album, for example, every song will say who the songwriters are.
Got it. So my dollars are helping support the songwriters.
Yeah. And actually we have, if somebody goes to our website, we've actually just started creating like a songwriter chart. So all the songs that you're familiar with, you know, that are on the chart today, we're trying to make it known that there are these behind the scenes players. And, you know, so we've actually started a chart of our own called the Hot Hitmakers List.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. So you're saying that you guys help with the quantitative aspect in terms of the historical royalties and,
Yeah. So that's the quantitative aspect. Then there's qualitative aspects as well. I mean, there is definitely, you know, investors are interested in music that they like or that they're familiar with. You know, we just auctioned off something where the songwriter had written songs for a lot of the Farrelly Brother movies. So there's Something About Mary, Dumb and Dumber, and some of those movies. And so, you know, we see when we have auctions of music that people are more familiar with, you know, they know that one, it's going to stay around for longer, you know, and two, they have a deeper emotional connection with it. You know, we sold a Barry White song, you know, You're My First, My Last, My Everything. And, you know, investors were, it's a song that they can all remember from their past.
Yeah. I could see how there's, you know, some emotional attachment to some of these songs. Does that ever, you know, misinform someone's judgment in terms of their investment, or is it actually helpful in your experience?
I think that is a good question, I would say. I think the emotional attachment to the song, everybody places a different value on. So it's actually hard for me to really make that assessment. The best example I would have is, we did auction off like a Dora the Explorer It was like the theme song to Dora the Explorer.
Oh, wow.
It's, you know, it went for prices that in my mind as an investor, I would have probably backed out of bidding at a certain stage. And, you know, when we talked to the investor, he said, you know, he's like, I'm doing this. I'm interested in the cash flow that it'll generate. I know it's not a lot of cash flow, but he's like, I got a 4-year-old daughter and I just really want to tell her that I own the theme song for this. I understand that Dora is something that I may place more value on because I think it may be around, but he places a whole different value on it than I would.
That's awesome. So can you talk a little bit about the economics of it? So what is a average investment? You know, what's an average royalty that a song generates? And, you know, what are some of the typical returns that you see?
So all of these are very different scenarios. We've auctioned things off on our website for as little as $5,000 and as high as $900,000.
So $900,000? Wow.
Right.
So, and is that a full license to the 100% of future royalties, or is that a portion, or how does that work?
It all varies by the deal. So the $900,000 was a single song. It did include the copyright. So whoever bought it could actually then, you know, do what they wanted with the song and try to exploit, you know, the copyright. Mm-hmm. We also have one on the site now for $1.2 million from an artist named Joe, who sang some R&B songs back in the early 2000s that have been generating income for over 15 years.
Wow.
And that one generated $170,000 worth of income last year. But it's not all of his royalties. It's actually just the digital royalties. And it's actually just a fraction of the digital royalties. So the interesting thing about the music business, and I was not in the music business when I started this, but for every song, there's a website out there called The Future of Music, and they've identified 42 different royalty types and income types that musicians get from their music. And so if you think about it, the more you're aware of music, you realize the prevalence of it all. You know, if you're out at a bar, that bar is having to pay. If you're listening to it on Spotify, that's a different type of royalty. So there's lots of different types and lots of different people involved that you can really carve out and make a really great solution for both the seller and the investor.
So I hope you guys enjoyed part one of the interview with Jeff Schneider on Royalty Exchange. In part two, we're going to be talking about piracy and how that affects Royalty Exchange. We'll also look into the specifics as to the economics and how Royalty Exchange makes money. And we'll also hear a little bit more about some of the more famous royalties that have been exchanged. One of them being Chris Brown. I hope everyone enjoys the week, and until next time, ciao.